that was a great reading by June. Hard to follow. And so, would you call me a
Facebook question?
Yeah, that's good. And so nice to see poetry alive and well here, and it was so wonderful to listen to your poems. In fact, I wrote my own poem, but I was too chicken to share it. So you guys are braver than I am. As Billy said, I do love a travel writing, so I do travel poems, which is kind of a sort of hybrid genre, I guess. And the first poem I'm going to start with, but before I do, I actually want to thank Billy for bringing June and I here. This is so awesome. And so thank you very much. Yay, Billy. All right. I meant to ask Alba if there's a word, and probably many of you know at least one, that's untranslatable, like from Irish to English. You know those words that you can't directly translate? I'm sort of intrigued by those words in other languages. And so I wrote a poem about a word, madrugada, which is a Spanish word that's really hard to translate. It kind of means between midnight and dawn. And if you're an early worker, you're a madrugada. And so I thought I would start with this poem because June ended with a poem about a sort of, what did you call it? The next day? Or
waking up the next day.
So I thought I would just pick up where she started. Or ended, right? Yeah. Okay. Between midnight and dawn. San Jose, Costa Rica. The taxi's horn echoes through rain, August, the green season, your winter. You say, there's still time. Shadows drift, window bars, the yellow burn of street lamps. There is no word in English for this time between night and day. Madrugada, the gray pre-dawn, the nearly, mouth sour, sheep salty from sweat, from lust. These bones, no borders beneath thin skin of hunger. Synapses still fire the rhythms of salsa. Madrugada, when the leaving becomes part of the other world, of sleep, of dreams, when the dawn unties the earth from sky. There is no word for this. I rise from the mattress on the floor, gather my things, dress in the dark. You follow me barefoot into the street, hand me my bag, kiss my cheek. Hasta means I won't see you again. As I look at these poems, I realize I'm sort of going with a theme here. I asked Billy a couple of questions, you know, about Ireland, like how much did you tip, and is it okay to say fuck at a poetry reading? And Billy said, yes, say fuck. So this is going to be my moment here. This poem takes place in Santorini, Greece. Anybody been there? Santorini?
I've been there.
Probably a lot of you have been there because it's so close. Okay. It's called The Cross. The Albanian has told her, your eyes, they are beautiful, so I love you. Through a window, the sea swells over the black shelves of the caldera and the whitewashed rooftops. Disked clouds settle on the Aegean. You want to fuck me, she says. Yes, I want to make fuck, but I love you. Can both be true? A wooden cross hangs on the wall, the carved middle, a gold-painted sun. She wants to touch the gold center, like a child reaching out for the moon. You don't have to do that. Although it's sort of nice, because then I can find my poem while you're doing that. I'm going to read a poem about my family. I have kind of a wacky family. And this is about my parents and my father. It's called The Present Tense. When the lady at the funeral parlor hands Daddy over, she says, it isn't ashes, you know. That's what most people think, but really, it's bone fragment. It's so hot, the rest disappears. Mother says, she's heard quite enough. We load into my sister's convertible Mustang. Our hair clamors in the wind. Mother holds the wooden box of bone on her lap, stares into the rest of her days. Back at home, Mother puts Daddy on the shelf between Dante and Shirley MacLaine. I go to my old room where Mother keeps teddy bears, Dr. Seuss, Barbie Dreamhouse. For your children, she says. She still waits. I lie on the narrow bed, stare at the seafoam ceiling. Daddy used to say, some are too heart aware. But if you lie on your right side with the pillow at the edge of your ear, you won't hear it. Okay, so is it okay if I read a couple of paragraphs of prose at this poetry venue?
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah.
It's about the way that I became a poet. And this is going to be another weird thing, but I'm going to order a drink before I do it, because I would just like some water. I'm like, ugh. And I'm afraid I'm going to spit on people in the front if I don't get some. Right after I graduated from college, I went on a really, really long hike. Not that long, actually, by European standards. It was 230 miles through the Sierra Nevada. And the hike is called the John Muir Trail. It's a famous hike named after, thank you, a 19th century naturalist, John Muir, who is responsible for our national parks in the United States. And before I went on this hike, I didn't know what I wanted to sort of be. And I was 22, and on this long hike, I had a lot of time to think, and so that's where I realized I wanted to sort of be a poet, or that I was already a poet. And so I'm going to just read you three paragraphs, and it's from like that much into the book. Okay, so it's where I sort of figure out that I'm finding my voice on this long journey. And the chapter is called On Writing, and it starts with a quote from John Muir: "The power of imagination makes us infinite." The thing about being on the trail is that you have hours and hours to think. So at first you review the things you had been thinking about. Then you have the thoughts you were planning to have. But after that, you still have thinking time and no planned thoughts. So it's new territory. For me, being on the trail had been the first time I thought seriously about writing. I wanted to capture the landscape, how I felt out there. I tried drawing pictures, yet without much talent. My sketches bore very little resemblance to the land. So every day in my journal, I wrote. When I was little, I wanted to be a writer, like my father. I loved listening to the tapping of the typewriter keys. It was Daddy who bought me ice cream, took me clamming, called me kiddo. It was Daddy who prevented the doctors from breaking me in half. He was kind. He was a drunk who ignored me or crashed the car or shouted at me. I couldn't reconcile the different versions of Daddy, so they sat separate like boxes on the shelf. Like most little girls, I loved my Daddy, despite the shouting. When he was kind, whether he was making ice cream cones for me or driving me to the mountains so I could ski, drunk Daddy disappeared in the shadows of my imagination. Children are the masters of forgiveness, forgetting. Teenagers, however, aren't. By high school, I no longer wanted to be like Daddy, no longer wanted to be a writer, and decided I'd become a doctor. That is, until I realized I hated blood, especially someone else's. I wanted to be the sort of person who was good at science in the same way I wanted to be an early riser who drank protein shakes for breakfast and practiced yoga as the sun came up. I wanted to be someone else, to escape the core that held both Daddy and my own writer self. So I forgot what I was, forgot that I wanted to be a writer before I could write. On the trail, I began to remember. I spent so many hours alone, walking and thinking, that I could no longer distract myself from myself. I remembered reciting stories to my mother, who dutifully wrote them down. I then drew lopsided pictures to go with my stories, and we made little books out of them, some of which my mother has kept. Yet my father, who was most proud of me when I wrote stories, also seemed relieved when I announced I'd study the sciences. He figured that maybe he hadn't passed the burden of a writing life onto me. He knew what it was like to tell people at cocktail parties that he was a writer and then get the inevitable follow-up questions. Do you publish? Or what's your career? How do you make a living? My father did end up making a career out of writing. He wrote soap operas, which he considered selling out. But even that didn't last long. It's hard to know whether the failure led to drinking or the drinking led to failure, though I suspect it was the latter. Years later, my mother would tell me, he used to say, "I feel like I'm living in a black hole." Writing, and especially poetry, became so mixed up with my family history that it felt like a secret I had been charged with keeping. it wasn't until I went out into the woods with all that time to think that I realized I had inherited a love of nature from my father and also a love of words. It was the woods that I could go back to, the child Suzanne, the one who had forgiven him for the parts of himself he couldn't help. I finally began to feel compassion for the man who had struggled with writing, the man who felt like the harsh world, a world of wars and the Holocaust which claimed the lives of his cousins, rubbed at his skin like sandpaper. Maybe I couldn't see the world through my father's eyes, no more than I could wholly adopt John Muir's perspective, but I realized that I, like Walt Whitman, was large enough to contain multitudes. Yeah. Thank you. I'm going to just end with one more poem so we can end on a poetry moment.
Two more poems.
Two more? Okay.
Three more.
All right. Well, I'm not going to do three more. That's too many. But that was sort of heavy, so I'm going to do something a little light. It's a sonnet, so it's a traditional, sort of traditional. You'll see. I'm sure that you guys have these conferences here where you all go talk about writing and it all sort of esoteric and there's all these things about transgression and everything. I went to one of these sessions and I actually brought a former student of mine who is way more grounded than I realize I am, and her name is Nancy, and this takes place in Vancouver, British Columbia, and it's called After the Conference Session on Poetry and Transgression Sonnet. We meet the poet in the hotel bar. Sipping an apple martini, I ask for clarification just how far we can really go without having passed the proverbial line. After lengthy elucidation, an answer counting levels of complication and mainly the depth and complexity of thinking, the poet nods, stands up, thanks us, and says his goodbyes. I feel very satisfied. My friend Nancy, her face rather a blank, says, all this talk, transgression, poetry, lies, you got your answer, but it was all just talk. All I want to know is how big is this cock? I read that poem, and I had like at least five famous poets that I know ask me if it was about them. And it wasn't about any of the ones who asked. So the one who asked turned bright red when I told him it was about him.
Who was it?
It was Charles Harper Webb, actually. Do you know him? He's an American poet. He's not that famous. I mean, I guess we're like swimming in a really small pond. famous to poets. Okay. All right, really, one more or two more?
Two more, please.
Seriously? You guys want another drink, probably.
Two more.
Okay, all right, two more. This one is called Poem. Super original, right? Characters. You, him, all the other him, the past. Setting. The metallic taste of traffic, hot crack concrete, a crowded neon beach, the white smell of hibiscus, diamond head on the sunlit horizon, the present tense. Dialogue, he asks, were you a slut? Point of view, you tell him the truth, but tell it slant. The metaphor, the past is a shadow. In that dream, you bought invisible pants. Now you wear them under everything. The plot, you are always the one who leaves. I'm a liar. June says she's going to finish, and she does, and I don't. But this is the last one. And this poem is about India. How many of you have been to India? Oh, lady in the back, a couple people. Yeah. You all should go to India. I'm sort of obsessed with India. And I think I'm obsessed with it because of the juxtaposition of sort of life and death right there. You know, they're burning the bodies on the Ganges, and the children are running, flying their kites in the hot wind of the burning bodies. And the sort of sadness of, you know, the lepers begging with the beautiful fabric and the beautiful food and all of that. And so there's this sort of juxtaposition all of the time with the sort of sad and the sacred, or I don't know. So this poem takes place in Alleppey, India. and it's called The Sacred. The flare of cricket song burns into the night, the rooster's answer to the darkness, to the light. The veined wind shakes the reeds and lanterns sway against the southern sky. Two men saunter hand in hand, smile at me, say, hello, then what is your country? Women wearing saris and flip-flops move earth in metal tins and bent shovels. They carry rocks on their heads. Children beg, one school pen, please. They play games with coconuts, swing from palm fronds, turn cartwheels on the sand, splash in the Arabian Sea. Walk along the shore through the rice paddies into your own malaria dreams. Give a leper food, unwrap it for him. Touch the stone of the temple before you enter. 3,000 years of looking forward, looking back.